area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
I know this story got around over the weekend, but this was just amazing enough, I think it bears repeating. Conrad Gregor plays minor league baseball for the Quad City River Bandits. You've heard of them. The Lugnuts play the River Bandits, right? His parents traveled 5 hours from their hometown in Indiana to catch a game over the weekend. It was a great day to make the trip. Conrad hit his first home run of the season, which turned the game around into a Quad Cities win, no less. His parents saw it from right center field. Some 5,000 spectators. His dad caught the ball. Amazing. What are the odds? I think I heard there were 5,500 people there, and they were in right center field, and that's right where Conrad hit it. And what a catch. An over-the-shoulder basket catch. You see people who get foul balls and homers, and they look like they've struck gold, you know, half the time. You should see Marty Gregor, the dad, in the video. Can you imagine how he must have felt? He caught his son's home run. Later this hour, we visit with a producer of the Moth Main Stage. Moth Storytelling takes the stage tomorrow night at the Wharton Center in East Lansing. And welcome back to Current State here after the long weekend. We're glad you're along. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and Chicago-based journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the Great Lakes Basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we have more on the efforts to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, and more from Waukesha, Wisconsin, and their water challenges. Gary Wilson, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. And before we go on to environmental things, I see a Hollywood script in the brewing on that home run story.
Oh, I think, yeah.
that's fantastic.
I think Kevin Costner is the dad. What do you think?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. A guaranteed box office smash there.
Yes.
Well, let's start with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps released the details of the feedback that it received on various options to keep Asian carp out of Lake Michigan. From the beginning, Gary, tell us what a few of these options were that people looked at.
Sure, Mark. There were a number of options, ranging from basically the status quo, relying on fish kills and the electrical barriers, which is sort of what's been done for the past 5 or 6 years, up to the big one, which was total physical separation, which was the Corps said would cost approximately $18 billion, could take 25 years. And there were iterations in between, sort of the middle ground approach, and that's what the Corps was seeking comment on for about 3 months after the study was released, and they did receive 1,800 individual comments, 40% of which were favored physical separation in some form. 40% favoring physical separation, 35% wanted the waterways kept open for shipping and recreational traffic. So that was sort of the Corps' analysis of the comments that they received.
So when you say 35% favored keeping the waterways open, that is that the same thing as no separation?
No separation, or maybe some devices in the waterways that would make their best effort to keep the carp at bay, but still allow for barge traffic and recreational boat traffic to go through. The real kicker in all this is, and the environmental groups are very upset about the Corps' release here, because the Corps didn't include in those percentages 7,000 comments that were received from environmental groups. That were really submitted via form letters, so to speak. Environmental groups issue action alerts, and people get a form letter, and they sign it, and then it gets submitted to the Corps. The Corps didn't include those into the percentages. They did report them. They weren't keeping it hidden. But the environmental groups are crying foul, saying that had you included those comments in the percentages, it would have been 90%. Favoring physical separation. I think all of this is nice, but it's sort of an academic argument. Public comments are great. We love them. But at the end of the day, the Congress mandated this study, and Congress has to do something. And it's about the money. Where is this money going to come from to do almost anything, especially for physical separation? You know, the low-end estimates, not given by the Corps, but given by others, are in the, you know, $3 to $4 billion range. So we can bash the Corps all we want. Environmental groups like to do that, and sometimes the Corps deserves it. But at some point, the ball's got to move forward, and that's going to take congressional leadership to step and do something, and step up and do something, and find the money. That's the challenge.
Is there a history of tension then between environmental groups and the Corps?
Always long-term tension between environmental groups and the Corps. Now they do work as best as they can to get along. They show up at the same conferences. They have working relationships, but the tension isn't too far beneath the surface. The Corps likes to build things. That's what the Corps does. They build dams. They manage waterways. They build structures to raise and lower water levels. You know, environmental groups at the other extreme, they like the natural flow of water. So there's a built-in tension there, and they do try to work together. My issue here is that bashing the Corps is easy, and it doesn't really do anything at this point. Environmental groups would be better to channel their energy working with congressional leaders and building consensus on what to do. And I would remind you, when I spoke with Governor Snyder a couple weeks ago when he was in Chicago, the governor was very explicit. He said, we don't have a consensus in this region on what to do. And we also lack a sense of urgency that needs to exist before anything of substance can really happen.
We're talking with Gary Wilson in our monthly Great Lakes Month in Review. Gary's on the line from Chicago. Is this solution just too politically risky for anyone to back the separation or any of the other options there? It's really expensive. The scope is immense.
I think it is, Mark. Boy, tell me in the current economic environment and with Congress at odds over funding on issues, who politically is going to step up and build a coalition, and that's what it would take, a political coalition of Republicans and Democrats, and say that we need to fund in the billions of dollars a multi-year, maybe even multi-decade project. That's a tough political sell when there are so many other needs for the money.
Remind us where Governor Snyder stands on this. Is he the physical separation guy, or is he keep the waterways open?
Well, he's he's kind of a little bit all over the place. He said he could, could support physical separation, but there needs to be a consensus. We need to take into consideration Illinois and Indiana's issues, because the waterways in those two states would be the ones that would have to be replumbed, and there are economic costs, to that. So the governor is kind of, he's sort of on the fence. In fairness to him, and I've been critical of him for not taking a more forceful stand, because he is the governor of the Great Lakes State, but this is a federal issue. The Army Corps of Engineers is in the federal government. They work for the president ultimately. So, it's up to people like Senator Stabenow in Michigan, who's been very outspoken on this. She would be the logical person to try to build a consensus. Mm.
We're talking with Gary Wilson about the Great Lakes environmental news here for the month of May. There was an oil spill in Lake Michigan last March at the BP refinery in Whiting, Indiana. We just reported here on Friday on oil that got dumped into the Grand River in Jackson here about a week ago. There's the Enbridge pipeline and the Kalamazoo River. Was there much outcry in Chicago over the spill last March into Lake Michigan?
It did get quite a bit of press. You've got some pretty big media groups here, with the Chicago Tribune reporter there, the environmental reporter Michael Hawthorne. He's really been watchdogging British Petroleum for a number of years now, and he gave it quite a bit of coverage. Media here, the public television station, and a number of media groups paid quite a bit of attention to it, and it got a good solid 3 or 4 days of airtime. So it's on people's radar here, and anything British Petroleum does down in the Whiting, Indiana plant, which borders on Chicago, gets quite a bit of scrutiny. I did take note of the spill in Jackson, which was that spill in Indiana, by the way, was at the Whiting plant, was very small, but a spill is a spill. But I did take note of the Jackson spill, and it seems to me, Mark, that there's another spill. Granted, it didn't rival the Enbridge spill in the Kalamazoo River a few years ago, but it's another spill. And one of my concerns, and this would be a good question for your listeners, are we becoming sensitized to these? Kind of like, okay, oil spills are a way of life, and we just have to get used to them, be prepared to clean them up. But they are what they are, and I think that's something we need to pay attention to. I don't think we wanted to just assume that oil spills are, a given.
They always seem to be on the landscape. It's like we don't go very long without some other major or minor spill.
Exactly, and yeah. I was just reading a story this morning in the Milwaukee newspaper, the Journal Sentinel. Enbridge has a major pipeline running through Wisconsin, and they're planning to increase the volume, and there's a lot of concern up there.
Shifting gears back to Waukesha, Wisconsin, where there always seems to be some Great Lakes news lately. Briefly remind our listeners of what's going on in Waukesha, Gary, with regard to the Great Lakes Basin.
Well, Waukesha, Wisconsin is that town just outside the Great Lakes Basin. They've got a water problem, and they need to find an alternate source for water. Their preferred source is Lake Michigan. And they've been working on an application to build a pipeline and divert Lake Michigan water to Waukesha. It hasn't been released from the Wisconsin DNR yet, and once it does, it'll go to the other eight states for review and hopefully approval if you're Waukesha. But one thing surfaced this past week that really caught my attention. The cost of the pipeline, if this request is approved, the cost of the pipeline is $200 million. Waukesha officials were in Washington recently lobbying for about $50 million in federal money, probably to come from the Army Corps of Engineers, to help defray the cost of the pipeline. Now, I found that to be fascinating. I think that takes some chutzpah. I could think of another word, but you'd probably beat me off the air here. But, yeah, okay, you've got a request to divert Lake Michigan water. I think it's a marginal request, but it may or may not pass. So now you're going to go to other taxpayers within the region, ask Michigan taxpayers potentially to help subsidize the cost of the pipeline. I understand politics, but that takes a lot of guts or something, in my opinion.
And I understand there was discussion with the city of Milwaukee in terms of addressing Waukesha's water needs.
Well, yes. Milwaukee was the primary source. Milwaukee has the water infrastructure. They have capacity. They are the closest source to Waukesha. The cost to build the pipeline coming out of Milwaukee was going to be about $164 million. So they started discussions with Waukesha, but Milwaukee had two demands. One, that they would supply water to the city of Waukesha only, and not to a broader service area like Waukesha wants. The mayor of Milwaukee has said repeatedly that to provide water to the service area is not in compliance with the Great Lakes Compact, and he doesn't want to do it. And the other issue was Milwaukee wanted to link the water deal to a joint venture on regional transportation. There currently isn't regional transportation between the two cities, and Waukesha didn't want anything to do with either one of those issues. So they quickly folded up their cards and started looking for other suitors, and they found another one. But it's going to cost them another $40 million or so, and they want federal taxpayers to help support that.
What's at stake for Michigan in this debate?
Michigan takes some precedent here. Michigan is the only state that's really immune for Michigan will never have to file a request to divert Great Lakes water because it's almost all in the Great Lakes Basin. So Michigan's got a strong hand, and it's very sensitive. When I talk to people in Michigan, you talk about diverting water, and boy, that's a huge red flag. And now, if you tell them that, some of your tax dollars could have to go to help support the pipeline to Waukesha, I don't think that's going to sell well there. By the way, I did contact the Army Corps of Engineers, and they don't currently have any funding to support Waukesha's request. It would have to go through an authorization process through Congress. So it's that's another big hurdle for Waukesha.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist based in Chicago. Gary joins us on the last Tuesday of every month to recap the latest news from the Great Lakes Basin. Gary, thanks for your time.
It's good to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. It's Current State for Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR or listening online at WKAR.org. We appreciate it. We've spent a considerable amount of time on Current State talking about health care reform. Today we're focusing on another costly proposition for the industry and for patients, rehospitalization. Nationwide, a significant number of people who leave the hospital return within days or weeks for another stay. The reasons for this are varied. A conference taking place tomorrow at Michigan State University seeks to address how to implement better transitions between healthcare settings. We're joined today by Sam Watson. Sam is Senior Vice President for Patient Safety and Quality with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. The MHA is a co-sponsor of the conference. Sam Watson, welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
About 5 years ago, I spoke with a national expert on care transitions, Dr. Stephen Jenks, for a story that I was working on. And at the time, he told me that a patient moving from the hospital to their next phase of care is, and these are his words, quote, sort of like an astronaut going between space stations without a spacesuit. In 2014, 5 years later, have these healthcare transitions improved?
Quite frankly, Mark, we're still working towards making sure that person's in a spacesuit. The challenges are real in care transitions. Patients are far more complex. The area in which they live in may have certain challenges in terms of resources or lack of resources. It's still a very big problem, but we are making gains.
Why? Tell us a little bit more about why these transitions are so complicated. Is there a pattern of causes that emerges as to why someone who leaves a hospital is back in the hospital just a short time later?
Certainly. So there are common causes as well as causes that are specific to a given community. So a common cause, we see patients returning because of medications. They may have had a change of medication during their hospitalization, and when they leave, either their pharmacy doesn't carry that specific medication or it's not on their formulary for the insurance company, and so their treatment can't continue as planned. That's a relatively common thing that we're working to address across the patient's experience. Mm. You may have also something that's unique to a community. The southeast part of our state has, unfortunately, a high degree of homeless, and those patients don't have a home to go back to. So they find it difficult to continue their after-hospitalization care in a way that would keep them from being readmitted.
I'm looking at part of the presentation that one of your keynote speakers tomorrow, Sherry Latimer, mm-hmm. An executive with the National Transitions of Care Coalition, which is really instructive here. She will explore what's labeled the conventional approach to healthcare and compare it with a collaborative approach to care. And at the top of her list, she points out that we're moving from an authoritarian model of healthcare to a collaborative model. Tell us just a little bit more about that transition.
That's a great question.
That's at the heart of this thing, it would appear.
It really is. What we're doing tomorrow is we're bringing people together from the entire care continuum, from hospitals to home care to long-term care, and even patients are invited to participate. And this idea of collaboration is you and I are responsible at some level for our own health care. But unfortunately, the way health care, as we typically think about it, has been, it's been more paternalistic than collaborative. And so what we've done is we've worked with physicians and nurses in hospitals. We certainly are working with those outside of the hospital to invite the patient in, if you will, which seems odd to say it, but making it comfortable for you and I to interact in our own healthcare.
Mm-hmm. One other part of Sherry Latimer's presentation, we're moving from a physician-driven model to a patient-centered model, which suggests this shared responsibility.
Absolutely. We've done a lot of work in this space within the Michigan Health and Hospital Association's Keystone Center, where we have actively sought to engage patients. There are some great examples around the state of hospitals that have patient councils. So a person who's been a patient in the hospital can voice what they think are helpful ideas around care, how to better involve the patient, and address things such as health literacy, where I explain to you your discharge instructions, and then you're able to repeat back in a way that you understand how to act on those instructions versus that 4-foot stack of paper that you get at discharge and you have to figure out after you get home.
Sam Watson is Senior Vice President for Patient Safety and Quality with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. We're talking about hospital or rehospitalization, which will be one of the key topics at a day-long conference tomorrow at the Kellogg Hotel and Conference Center in East Lansing. I do notice that the states invariably are rated in terms of who performs better and who performs worse. I see Washington State has one of the nation's lowest hospital readmission rates. What are they doing that other states like Michigan could learn from?
That's a great question. The work that's happened in Washington State is very similar to what we've begun to do here in Michigan. They've brought everybody together in a very focused way around care transitions. And we used to talk about it in terms of rehospitalization prevention. Rehospitalization is a measure. What we really are focused on are care transitions.
Okay.
And so Washington State has done something very similar where they brought all the entities together so there's open communication across the care transitions.
I came across an acronym for a new kind of organization here. Another part of Sherry Latimer's keynote tomorrow concerns, new models of healthcare delivery and reimbursement. And one of them, apparently, is the Accountable Care Organization, an ACO. Is that, are we going to be hearing more about ACOs in the future?
Absolutely.
And what is an accountable care organization?
So ACO, that's something that actually came out of health reform, is this accountable care organization concept, where essentially you have a population that a given healthcare system is responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, for example, in the Lansing area, one of the hospitals or two of the hospitals would be in an arrangement that they're responsible for the overall health care of the population in the Lansing area. They would have to build relationships with physicians, long-term care, rehab facilities. And for that management, there is a given amount of money to be spent. The Accountable Care Organization essentially helps to spend the money in the most effective way of delivering care. If your care is best delivered outpatient, that's where it should be given. If you have an acute illness that you need to be hospitalized and then transferred to rehab, essentially the care and the money, if you will, follow the patient.
Okay. I'm sure technology plays a huge role in this transition, and I'm thinking of all of the smartphone apps and online apps that can help patients better manage their own care at home. Is this going to be an increasing thing? What role are those playing now? What role will they play in the future?
I've seen some really impressive apps that are out there that allow a patient to be instructed in terms of what their needs are. So if you're hospitalized, the last point of your care being discharged, it's really difficult to get all the information you need to know during that last couple hours of healthcare,
right,
of your admission. And so the idea is that you pace along during the patient's admission the information they need to know to care for themselves afterwards. Some of these apps have been that I've seen have been quite powerful in doing just that, even to the point of being able to show you a picture of the pharmacy that you go to. That technology is still early in its implementation. Integrating it into electronic medical records is still a pretty significant challenge, but I think we're going to see more and more of that in a very short time.
What kinds of ailments are most common among patients who find themselves rehospitalized not that long after being discharged? There must be a pattern there.
There are. There's certainly patients who have chronic disease. So, for example, congestive heart failure, cardio-obstructive pulmonary disease. Those are lifelong and unfortunately life-ending conditions over the course of time. Those patients are very complicated. They're very sick. And as their disease progresses, the likelihood of their being hospitalized increases. And so those are the kinds of patients that you see more often than not. We also will see patients who are have a what's called a comorbidity. So they have their main disease.
Comorbidity. Okay.
Their main disease, and then they have something else to go with it. For example, diabetes, which unfortunately is pretty significant in Michigan. That may help a patient lead to further hospitalizations.
And is government playing a role in all of this, in cutting down on rehospitalization?
Well, there are certainly payment penalties associated with rehospitalizations now. That's part of the Affordable Care Act. It's also part of what's called value-based purchasing. So the federal government essentially has moved from this idea that you pay for the number of times a patient's hospitalized to value. And so for certain conditions, some of which I mentioned, heart failure, acute myocardial infarction, also known as a heart attack, pneumonia, there are penalties that a hospital is subject to if they have a higher than expected readmission rate.
We had Andy Hetzel of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan on here not too long ago, and we talked about all of these. I referred to them at one point as disincentives, and I don't know if that's the best word for that or not, but it would appear to be something like a disincentive if obviously you have to endure a greater percentage of rehospitalization. So a really interesting topic. We want to thank Sam Watson, Senior Vice President for Patient Quality and Safety with the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. We're talking healthcare transitions tomorrow all day at the Kellogg Center in East Lansing. Thank you, Sam.
It's been a pleasure, Mark.
The Frankensteiner, the diving bulldog, the double chicken wing. No, these are not submarine sandwiches. They are wrestling moves. And before the International Ring of Grapplers was founded in Lansing 2 years ago, the best chance you'd have of seeing one of these maneuvers and the high-flying wrestlers who performed them was likely on television. But since 2012, the Pro Wrestling League has staged more than 16 live events, many in the Lansing area, and there's another one coming up in a couple of weeks. Here to tell us more about the local wrestling scene, Ricky Pinnell Jr., one of the co-founders of the International Ring of Grapplers, or IROG. Also with us, Danny Shea. Danny's a pro wrestler based here in Lansing. He's listed at 5'11", 220 pounds. I do not have a bicep measurement, however. Welcome to both of you, Ricky and Danny.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Ricky, you're one of the co-founders of the International Ring of Grapplers. Tell us about how you got started. What possessed you to start a pro wrestling league in Lansing?
Well, actually, it's a friend of mine named Rigo Flores. He's like a fanatic about wrestling in every sense of the word. And, you know, a love for wrestling and music, things of those sort, that just, and a need for it in this area and family-friendly events. It's like, why not bring it to Lansing and things of that sort? You got WWE. Why can't we be the next thing out?
So his enthusiasm was contagious, basically,
very much so.
And you caught it as well. Did you guys do any market analysis? I mean, how did you know that there'd be enough fans out there to sustain this?
Actually, like I said, with him being such a fanatic about it, and he actually went into training. So he actually took the time to figure out and to see what was actually valuable to go about making this company actually work and to see if there was a market for it. So once we got into it and actually talked to different promotions throughout the state, not only in this area, it gave us a better shot at seeing where we needed to be at.
What kind of regulatory challenges did you have to deal with? I mean, were there bureaucratic hoops you had to jump through? I mean, licenses and insurance and all of that stuff?
Yeah, definitely. All the paperwork, that's always a headache in any sense of the word. Then also with the marketing of actually trying to let people to be more accustomed to seeing what we have going on with the wrestling, the different types of entertainment that we can provide for them, actually finding the different venues, that's a different situation in itself. But once you get through all those different problems, it's that much more easy to figure everything out and actually try to put on actually a good show.
And how do you find wrestlers like Danny?
Well, we have a great booker that goes by the name of Josh, Roger Street. He's a wrestler too. So when you have guys within the industry and know how to find the right guys, it makes it that much more easy.
Danny, you're a pro wrestler in the IROC. How long have you been wrestling professionally then?
A couple of years now. I just trained a couple of years ago and then got back active last October, actually. So.
And you trained for this. Tell us about your training. What did it entail?
It was 12 weeks, 4 nights a week, 4 hours a night of training. And it was pretty grueling, actually.
They just didn't send you to Navy SEAL training?
It felt like it.
I can imagine. I read an article last night about what Navy SEALs go through.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So 4 nights a week, 4 hours,
yep.
4 hours a night.
At the House of Truth in Detroit is what it was. I looked at a couple schools. I thought about going to Tampa, Windsor, all these other places. But I met the promoter. The guy there, Truth Martini, and I knew right away there was
a fit.
The
guy's name is Truth?
And Truth Martini.
The House of Truth.
Yeah, the House of Truth, yeah. He's an agent for Ring of Honor. He's one of the best in the industry. He's also a manager in the industry, too. And he's probably the best trainer, I think, personally.
What did they teach you?
They teach you everything from etiquette to how to walk,
etiquette
how to talk.
Was not the first thing I was expecting to come out of your mouth.
Hey, we have class.
Tell us. We got a man. He's a well-mannered pro wrestler. Come on. Tell us about what is one point of etiquette that you learned in your training?
One thing was when you're a new guy, you ears open, mouth shut.
Okay.
Because you don't want to be the guy, the loudmouth in the locker room everybody don't like, you know.
Why am I not surprised to hear that one? What kind of toll does this take on your body?
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, the first time I trained, I broke 3 ribs 6 weeks in. So, that was just from, training. But the bumps that you take and all this kind of stuff, each one you take on that mat is a 30-mile-an-hour car crash on your body.
I can imagine.
So that's why a lot of these guys at 40, 45, sometimes 50, if they get lucky, are stumbling around. Hard to get around or whatever, yeah. But we're crazy, so we like the business. So.
We're crazy and we're proud, but we're crazy. Who pays your health insurance?
I do.
Okay.
I pay for it out of my own pocket, actually. So.
Now, there are storylines involved. Some of our listeners are going to be shocked to hear this, but there are storylines involved in professional wrestling. How do you guys know? Tell us about those storylines, Ricky.
You can say basically with the storylines, depending on the theme and what we want to have for the show, and then also when it comes to booking guys like Danny, once we figure out, hey, say around you want to have a Halloween show. So, recently we had an event where we had Michael Myers versus Captain America, actually.
Okay.
So, and having a match like that, you're just trying to figure out.
There's a storyline.
Yeah, and it's so, because you're just like, okay, let me see. Is he actually going to die or is he going to come back? Michael Myers, what's really happening? But so, when you have those type of things, it makes it kind of that much more easy to figure out, what type of matches. And then sometimes we might, on the fly, depending on whoever we may or may not book, we can just change it up as we go, depending on if the match is going too long or the right people aren't there, to actually make the match as strong as it should be. So we just throw at different monkey wrenches in a situation, and it makes it that much more entertaining, I think, for the fans, because We have guys go out into the crowd with the fans. Fans might get an elbow in or something of that sort. So it's a lot of times, yeah, you're right, it's predetermined. But, hey, isn't the movies that we watch, too, as well? So,
how do you participate in that process, Danny?
They pay me, so I do what they tell me to do. Okay. So, yeah. I can have input or whatever, you know, because all of us collectively working together makes the show that much better. But usually the promoters and the guys running the show know what they're doing, so you just kind of go with the flow with what
they
say.
But there is some spontaneity involved in this thing. Now, and we've got the face and we've got the heel. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the face and the heel.
The baby face is the technical term, the good guy. That's for the ones that the fans all want to cheer for. They want them to win. The heel is the guy who's getting away with, you know, he's cheating. He's getting away with everything. The ref isn't seeing it, you know, and the fans can't stand the guy. But they love to hate him usually.
So Captain America is the baby face, and Michael Myers is the heel.
It might be the other way around. Yeah,
depending on if it's a Halloween show, they might cheer for Michael Myers. So,
what is the scariest moment you've had while wrestling?
My first match, I went head first into the mat. I almost broke my neck. Pretty much, I heard a crunch, a flash, and then I just kind of laid there in the ring, got rolled out of the way because it was a 4-on-1 match. We were against this 6-foot-plus, 300-plus pounder.
Four against one?
Yeah, we got our butts kicked. But
wow.
But that was the move. I chose to take the move that he said, "You want to take it?" So I said, "Sure." I figured he knew what he was doing, and what happened is I got spiked in the mat instead. So,
any second thoughts after that?
No, I went to training the next day.
Episode.
I went back at it the next day.
Right back at it the next day.
Toughness.
What's your favorite moment so far? Is there a moment of pride and glory that you have played over and over in your head?
Honestly, it's my favorite moments is when the crowds are into it. You know what I mean? The more they're into it, the better. The easier it is for me. So the better I do my job when I'm out there working that crowd, the better it is overall. It's a sense of joy. I've always been want to entertain people since I was a kid. So on a grand scale, a larger than life scale, being able to entertain people and sway their emotions like you do, it's probably the greatest experience right there.
Our guest today on Current State, Danny Shea, a pro wrestler based here in Lansing and a member of IROG, the International Ring of Grapplers. We're also talking with one of the co-founders of IROG, Ricky Pinnell Jr. Ricky, what's been your highlight since you've started doing this?
I could say our biggest highlight, like, we have an event coming up June 13th, and it's, I could say, like, the festivals that we've been a part of within the state. And actually, like Danny said, like, providing joy and entertainment for the youth and just families in general throughout the area, because there's so much different crazy things going on. But to actually give them something on a Friday night or a Saturday night that they can enjoy themselves to and actually see that elation on their face, you can't beat that. Mm-hmm. You can go to the movies if you want to, but you can go to Netflix and watch the same thing, but you can't go to a live event and then actually get involved in it. We had a hot dog eating contest, different things where the fans get to jump in, throw pies at our ring announcer. So it's like, and we were at Rockapalooza in Jackson last year, so we had fans come in and do bumps with the wrestlers. So it's like, when you have those different things going on, you can't beat it. The smile and the joy, and then parents jumping in, screaming at the wrestlers. This is a great time overall.
Do you feel like support for this is growing in the Lansing area?
Definitely. So we were just recently within past two issues of the City Post paper, so, and that's a mid-Michigan guy, so we're not touching the radar of a lot of people. I think they're starting to put us out there that much more. Yeah. Then we get respected.
And tell us more about the when and where of your next event.
Our next event is June 13th at 6 p.m. at Green Union Hall, which is located at 1200 Marquette, Lansing, Michigan. It's Think Live Music. They're a live production company. They're basically like our family, like our sister-brother company. Ticket prices are $5, but you can definitely, when you come out, you're just going to enjoy yourself. It's live pro wrestling. You can't beat it. Friday the 13th is the theme, so you can just imagine what might just happen. Might bad luck, good luck, anything.
It is the night for a wrestling event.
Absolutely.
Ricky Pinnell Jr. is one of the co-founders of the International Ring of Grapplers, or IROG. Danny Shea is a pro wrestler based here in Lansing. Gentlemen, thanks for talking pro wrestling with us today.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A group of outstanding storytellers will be in East Lansing for a show at MSU's Wharton Center Wednesday night. The Moth Main Stage brings a live performance of the Moth Radio Hour program to audiences all over the country. To learn more about the Moth, Current State Scott Pohl talked with producer Jennifer Hickson.
What is the Moth, and where did the name come from?
Well, the Moth is a nonprofit. We put on shows of people telling stories. It's a very simple concept. We live in this digital age, and I think people are really hungry right now for people to sit around the campfire, which we don't always have so many campfires around. So now we put it on a stage, and we have shows all over the country where we invite people to get on stage, tell stories, and we don't interrupt them. We just let them go on. And the name came from our founder, George Dawes Green, who's a poet and writer. He grew up in Georgia and would tell stories with friends with a bourbon and share tales. And this one group of friends would meet on a porch quite often, and there were some holes in the screen of the porch, and moths would come in as the night grew long, and so they started to call themselves the Moth. And when George moved to New York and really wanted more time for people to tell stories, he decided, I'm going to have a night at my house, and I'm going to call it the Moth. I'm just going to invite a couple of my friends who are cool and have neat stories. And it has grown and grown, and so now we're putting on a show in East Lansing, Michigan.
I want to know if there are any rules that you give your storytellers.
Well, number one, the stories need to be true. We also have a time limit on stories. We ask that they're 10 to 12 minutes, and we have a timekeeper on stage who will give them a little note that acts as a vaudevillian hook, although we never actually drag anybody off stage with a hook. But the violin note is a gentle reminder, time to wrap it up here. We don't encourage people to do stand-up comedy or just be confessional. It really needs to be a story. We ask folks to look for turning points in their lives. Not necessarily a giant change, although some of them are, but just identify a moment in your life. That's the difference between an anecdote and a story. One is just, an anecdote is something that happened that could be very amusing, and a story, by our definition, is the storyteller's changed. The storyteller sees life a little differently after whatever happened.
If you want the stories to be true, to what lengths, if any, do you go to verify that these stories are true to life?
Well, we don't do a whole lot of fact-checking, but we work very closely with the storytellers, and we trust them to tell the truth. That's kind of as far as it goes. Personal stories are subjective. Obviously, if someone said they were an opera singer at the Met, I would pretty much believe that they were. It would be pretty outrageous for someone to push that any further and pretend they were an opera singer or they played for the Mets. But all these stories happen in our lives, and time alters them slightly, but we weren't there, so it isn't journalism, the stories, but they are true as the storyteller remembers them, is how I think we like to phrase it.
Well, tell me about the storytellers who will be in East Lansing.
We have got quite a wonderful bunch for you. Three of them are from Michigan, so I'll start with them. We have Horace Sanders. He's a guy from Detroit. He's a stand-up comedian, but his story is, although it's funny, it's a true story from his life. And I'm sure this one, I have seen the pictures, everything. I've seen all the corresponding documents to go with his story. He's a funny man who has a relationship story. He has a wife and 9 children, and so he's telling a story about a time when things changed in his life for a while. And also from Michigan, Auburn Sandstrom, who her story takes place in Ann Arbor when she's an undergraduate student. No, I think actually she's a graduate student, and it's about a pretty dark time in her life when a little bit of light came in and changed things for her. And Tina Zimmerman is from where she's from, let's see, in Manchester, Michigan, and she was a stay-at-home mom and is now a clergy person, and her story is about making that change from being a full-time mom to working in the church. And then some other folks that we're bringing in from other places. We have Bobby Stoddard, who's a carpenter from Vermont, who has a story about a crazy incident on a ski slope. And Taylor Negron, who's an actor. He's from Los Angeles and New York. And his story is about when his childhood dream comes true and he gets a monkey as a pet. And the monkey is, well, you'll just have to come and see the show. But it wasn't all that he thought he would be.
The theme for the night is Twist of Fate, and I assume all these stories reflect that theme.
They do. Twist of Fate is one of our favorite themes because this is where all stories happen. It's not a story if your life is just going on as usual and everything happens as planned. It's always in those moments when something you didn't expect come up that turn you in a different direction, set you down a different path, and change your life, ultimately change your life. Not all twists of fate are end up that way, but many of them. If you think back on your own life, you'll be like, oh, yeah, that's right. I got that job because I ran into that person, or I fell in love because I happened to go to that that meeting that day. So many things that happen to us are a twist of fate.
A twist of fate can be a good thing, and it can be a bad thing.
That's absolutely right, and that will be reflected in this evening. You'll see.
When you travel around the country with The Moth, is the theme typically consistent from show to show to show, and are the storytellers the same from show to show to show?
No, every place we reuse things because we like them, but we try to change up our stories all the time. No two Moth story shows are the same, ever. Maybe there'll be a story in there that's the same, or one or two storytellers who we've worked with in another city and decided, oh, we'd like to bring them along because they're so much fun. But we always take some local people and work with them. And also, the stories themselves are a little bit different because our stories aren't written down and rehearsed like in a play. They are remembered, the storyteller remembers them on stage. Of course, we have worked out parts of them, and up there, of course, will be phrases that someone says exactly the same over and over, just as we do in our stories. I know there's stories I've told again and again, and I'm sure you too. You know, the punchline, you always deliver it the same exact way. Your favorite and best stories sort of have a little rhythm to them. But even the stories are different as we go to different places. People who are repeating storytellers, the story takes on a different flavor in a different city.
Listeners who hear the Moth program every week are familiar with Ophira Eisenberg, who's also hosting the program in East Lansing. For people who are listening to this interview who aren't familiar with her, tell me about Ophira Eisenberg.
Well, she is a hilarious comedian, but also a wonderful storyteller. She hosts a trivia radio show called Ask Me Another, but she has been, way before she took on that job, she has been hosting The Moth for us for many years. We have a little program called, it's not little actually, it's all, they're in cities all over. There's one in Ann Arbor and in Detroit every month, a thing called a Story Slam, which is an event that's open to anybody. We put out a theme, you know, the theme will be busted or revenge or love hurts or joy. And people come and prepared with a 5-minute story, and it's a competition. And Ophira has been hosting those competitions for us for many years. They're really fun nights and populated by all local people. So, you know, you'll hear your dentist, your cab driver, your dog walker, your math teacher, all sorts of people get up and tell stories. Actually, and two of the people from Tina Zimmerman and Auburn Sandstrom I found at the Story Slam in Ann Arbor. And they told stories that really stood out, and I just thought, wow, these are cool women, and they have more, and let's try and give them the space to tell a longer story. So now they're bumped up from 5 minutes to 10 to 12 now, so they're getting to stretch their legs a little more.
For the benefit of people who aren't familiar with The Moth, there are podcasts of full The Moth programs. Also, individual stories are sent out via podcast. It might be a way for people to try out a couple of them. In fact, I remember hearing the story about getting a monkey on a podcast. So people can maybe try it out that way and then decide to come to the show in East Lansing having had a taste for it.
You are so right. But I will tell you, the monkey story that you heard was a different getting a monkey story.
Oh, really?
There's more than one. Can you believe it? Yes, because I don't believe the one, the Taylor story, has not been podcast yet. So I believe you're talking about Ari Handel's monkey story. I hadn't realized we had more than one monkey story, but come on.
Now you have me intrigued.
Yes, more than one monkey story. We don't go out seeking monkey stories. They come to us. I don't know how it happened, but...
One last thing I want to make sure we point out is that the show might be advisable for those 18 and up. There might be some material and stories that wouldn't be suitable for some children.
That's true. I think that I don't think this story has anything racy, but there's some disturbing content. There's definitely a sad moment or two, but yeah, it's hard when you do something called storytelling. Everybody always naturally thinks that it's for children. But this is more grown-up storytelling, because we need stories too. Grown-ups like them also.
Jennifer Hixon, it's been great fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you, East Lansing, for having us.
Jennifer Hixon is producer of The Moth, coming to the Wharton Center on the MSU campus at 7:30 on Wednesday evening. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
In Current State, we're sorry to learn today of the passing of East Lansing Gallery owner Bill Hankins. Bill was an absolutely charming guy who for years was a fixture on the local art scene. It was my pleasure to become acquainted with Bill a little bit. A nice remembrance of Bill Hankins today by MLive's Megan Holland. Bill Hankins was 81. He and his wife Helen moved to Traverse City a few years back. That is our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll experiment with open science and its progress in changing how science is shared with the world. Also, we'll look into cyber crime prevention as the state of Michigan puts together an all-volunteer defense team. That and more Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.